Have a glass of water.
I don't provide water. Yes.
Then I'll just cough all the way through the podcast.
It's coming.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and with me is your, well, my co-host, Ian Mond. Hi, Ian.
I can be the world's co-host.
You can be the world's co-host.
I'm more than happy to take that
How
role.
Are you?
I'm very good.
That's
well,
good.
Well, I mean, you know, I've, like you got a cough.
Yes, we've both got coughs. And editing will be fun.
Yeah, we need to install a mute button.
Okay, I'll put that on the Patreon list because that's not something my little deck has. My deck does not have a cough button.
Do decks come with mute buttons?
If you get an expensive deck, you can get one with a cough button.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Okay. But not ours.
So, yeah, I it's the weather here's been very strange and as a result.
Oh, really? The weather?
My sinuses are all over the shop. Well, what's your problem?
I've got a cough.
Yeah, and what's brought that about?
A cold that I had at the beginning of the month.
That's because you live out in...
No, it's not. Anyway, we're not talking about the weather, we're not talking about illnesses, and we're not mentioning the T word.
What's that?
Oh, was that a reflex?
Yes. What's a T word?
Good. Excellent. So, what are we talking about this month, Ian?
Two books. Oh.
It's going to be a low-key podcast, listeners. Settle back, relax. We are.
So we're talking about Kelly Link's Get In Trouble.
Get In Trouble. I kept in my head thinking of it as Get Into Trouble as well, but Get In Trouble by
now,
Kelly Link.
Question, is there a story in the collection called Get In Trouble?
No, and neither is there a story in Helen Oyemi's collection, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours.
What's going on here?
What do you mean?
You have got to put...
Why?
You've got to... The title of your collection should be a story in the collection.
No, I don't think
that
it does.
That is what the rules
no,
say.
No? What rules? There
I don't
no
know.
Rules.
But that's
who made
what...
up these rules? They're silly rules because you know what? If you title it... And I know it's really, really, really common and I've done it, but if you do pick one of the stories as the titular story... You are drawing attention to that story above all others because that's what the anthologies are. Because that's what the collection's named
okay,
after.
Okay, then if you'd call it "Get in Trouble,"
then you're calling a collection a title of its own.
Okay,
and you're not singling out a story and saying this is the important story okay. I've based my collection around.
But then there's questions as to why you chose those three words to title your collection.
Aren't there questions about why you choose titles for any book?
Yeah, but often those titles. Will be reflected in the novel somewhere.
Well, I think these titles are reflected in both books, like in the content and the themes of the books, not in a particular story. It's a kind of an arbitrary rule, actually, isn't it? The idea that if you have a collection, single author collection, that is, because, you know, anthologies, of course, always have their own titles, which reflect the nature of the book.
Usually they're bland. Although Aikman's Heirs, Aikman's Heirs was a, well, but that was a clear mission.
The point is, right, with...
Yes.
Because you're not going to play favourites with your kids if you're an editor of an anthology,
It'd
right?
It'd be funny if they did that.
So you have a title for your anthology which will reflect something about the anthology itself, perhaps the series that it's in, but it will tell the reader the type of book that it is. And I actually think it's quite neat to have a single author, well, two this month, two single author collections where they have a title that is the title of the book and doesn't specifically reference one single story in the book and thereby singles
so you
out
think
or puts
Get
a focus
in Trouble
on it.
Reflects the themes of the novel. The novel. See, there you go.
There we
reflects
go.
Reflects the theme of the collection.
Well, there's the story and I apologise in advance, listeners. If you're a long-time listener, you'll know that I am terrible with titles of short stories and songs for that matter. So I'm going to struggle a little, especially with the Helen Oyemi book. We'll get to that. But there is a story, is it Light or near the end, which actually talks – oh, actually it might be the one with the girl who goes to the hotel in the Kelly Link story. Which uses the phrase get in trouble and what that kind of means. And it sort of, I think, reflects outwards on the collection.
Oh, I missed that.
Oh, you missed it.
Yeah, I'm going to do a search. You keep talking. I'm going to do a search and see if it actually does pop up.
So you read clearly both of these as digital books.
Yes.
As you can see, Ian,
yes,
I have
you've got beautiful hard copies.
And can I just say the Canongate hardcover of Get in Trouble by Kelly Link. Oh my God, it is such a beautiful book. It's black dust. Not a dust jacket. It's a black casing, and the pages are red on the edges, and it's very nice. It's a beautiful book. I really do love
it. It is gorgeous. It really is.
It is a really nice book.
I mean, look, I read 90% digital now. And this is the thing I miss.
Yeah, like it's a physically beautiful artifact. So I'm very glad I did buy it in the physical form. I did that just because I've got a couple of other Kelly Link books in lovely hardcovers. Now, there's some books you want on your shelf, isn't there?
Okay. I've just done a search because I've got a digital copy,
okay,
unlike you. And there are two times Get in Trouble are mentioned in the book. The first time is in Secret Identity, but I think it's a throwaway reference.
Okay.
It's just in dialogue. The second time I think is the one you were referring to before, which is in The Last Story Light.
Oh, so I was right on both counts. They're the two stories I said I thought it was in. It's in both. That's funny. Anyway, what's the reference in Light?
People with two shadows were supposed to get in trouble, supposed to be trouble.
And there we go.
That reference happens.
Well, I don't think it's accidental.
With like 7 or 8 pages left in the whole book. So.
But as I said, like often, or not often these days, because titles are, you know, with the way books are marketed, titles can be a bit more explicit now. But, you know, sometimes you get a book where you don't really get what the title means until the very end. And I like that Kelly Link is doing that. And I don't think it's – I cannot think it's accidental that she titles her book.
Of course it's not accidental. She's far too smart and too erudite.
So this is what she's sort of saying. These are what these stories do. They get in trouble.
The stories themselves.
Yeah.
They did get in trouble.
And this type of genre, right, that essentially is, you know, they're stories with two shadows. They're not of one or two.
Oh, my God. You need to say that again.
What?
Just say that again. They are stories with two shadows.
Yeah, or I'm paraphrasing what the character.
But that's awesome. But that's exactly what they are.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Like, that's why this book is really well titled, because her stories, and they always do, they straddle quite a realistic sort of storytelling genre. But they're also, they slip in all
I've
this fantastical stuff.
I've been trying to encapsulate in my brain. And it's been there in front, looking at you the whole time.
Looking at you.
How to explain it. Because the key one for me is two houses.
Oh, yeah.
Which is starts off as this sort of generationship story where people are being woken up. It is because there's a bunch of ships have gone off, Golga Frinchum style. That's a Hitchhiker's reference. You know, it's a generation ship. They're going off to colonize some other world.
Are there more people on the ships, though? Because that's what I didn't get. It didn't seem like there were any more than those.
But that's the point. It's a thin veneer, whatever it is. It's not. That's not the point. That is one shadow.
Right.
And the second shadow, which is the main one, that gets in trouble, which is this awesome ghost story. Awesome.
I loved the story in the story Two Houses more than I loved the story Two Houses.
But that's the point, though.
Yeah, I just
it's really just a framing thing.
I know it's a framing thing.
And she does that. I mean, you could say that about nearly all. I mean, the Summer People maybe not as much.
I think Two Houses is the we're clearly discussing Kelly Link's collection Get in Trouble first. as we seem to have just jumped straight in there. I think Two Houses is the only story where
correct.
It's a really explicit framing device.
No, but I'm going to make some for me an intelligent point. I think that each of these stories has one memorable set piece that could be considered the second shadow in a sense. So for example, in Secret Identity, the bit with the butter villains. Which is just extraordinary as a concept.
Yeah.
And that idea. So walking into this freezer and there's all
they're like ice sculptures.
Ice sculptures
but
made
of
butter.
Yeah.
But I mean, who would join those concepts together? And then there's another one in the second story, which wasn't one of my favourites. I Can See Right Through You, which is the one with the sex tape.
Oh, I really
that,
like
it. It jumps
that
around
story.
In time a lot.
Yeah.
But again, it has this memorable weird menage a trois ghosty element there that's and again ghost stories run through it as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of ghosty type stories in this book.
So maybe not every story, but nearly every story has this set piece to it that just is different or odd or extraordinary. It doesn't say, that comes from nowhere. That is that second shadow, that bit that gets in trouble.
I'm not sure what you mean by set piece. Well, I'm doesn't not have sure to be, that I read them
well,
the
it doesn't have
way.
To be an actual scene, but just a moment that's odd and out of kilter or there's nothing supernatural about the butter villains, as I
no.
call them.
Well, I mean,
but
I
it's memorable.
Like how I
can
think
walk
of
away
them.
From Secret Identity and not think about the actual thing between Paul Zell and the girl telling the story,
right?
And just focus entirely on these fucking statues made out of butter.
Oh, see, for me, the whole story was about Billy and.
Yeah, it is. It is a very good story. Don't get me wrong.
But I think that's like with these stories and some of them to a higher degree than others. You like with that story, for example, with Secret Identity, which is ostensibly about a 15-year-old girl who has had this online relationship that started in a some kind of online multiplayer role playing game, and she pretended to be her much older sister. So the guy. He's not a pedophile. He doesn't know she's 15. He hasn't been grooming her. If anything, she's been grooming him. So she's going to meet him, and yet the backdrop of this story is this convention at a hotel where she's going to
with
and
actual
at the convention.
Superheroes.
Well, there's a dentistry convention, and there's also a superhero, and there it's an actual superhero convention. As it's not cosplayers. It's like in this world there, and you could take that out of the story if you know what, like the story itself. It doesn't. Explicitly require there to be actual superheroes in the world.
Correct.
And that's sort of what Kelly Link does is she threads in this stuff, which is pocket universe stuff.
You could take them out. You could take the pocket universe out. You could take the generation ship out.
But if you did take them out, although they wouldn't affect the plot by plot story per se, if you substituted them for something actually real world, they wouldn't be these stories.
No, they wouldn't.
So they're essential.
But the new boyfriend is a case where you could take out these weird animatronic boyfriends, the werewolf.
See, that's where I think.
No, you could. You could replace it because it's a story about jealousy.
Well, it's a yeah, it is. It
and
is.
You could replace it with. But she's chosen that because of the dissonance it creates. Yeah. And it's and just the uneasiness because are they sentient? Are they not?
I think they're meant to be like.
Is this a sort of slavery?
See,
thing
the ghost
going on here?
Boy is only he only becomes sentient because Immy puts that little hair braid
Correct.
In his mouth,
yes.
And so he is now inhabited by two ghosts. But I don't think we're meant to think that about the rest of the boyfriends with a capital B because they are. Animatronic dolls.
I don't know.
There's an
uneasiness anyway because,
well, there is the uneasiness, but I don't like for me, I didn't read that as questioning that side of things because it's quite clear in several spots where Immy makes the distinction that, you know, the boyfriends aren't real. And in fact, when she takes the hair wreath out of the ghost boyfriend, Mint. He just not that. Like, it's clearly that is coming from the hair and it's coming from the ghost and that is what animates. And it could be anything. That you know, you could have a baby doll that had been animated by a ghost or anything like that.
And that's why they were recalled because they did start to show sign of.
Yeah, centuries. maybe. If you did implant them with something.
But the dissonance of a society that would see this as something you could sell to kids. I just can't imagine buying for my daughter
or
son.
They're not children,
a literal boy toy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. But I found it perfectly permissible. Like in the sense of it felt like a very real world story. I didn't think, look, maybe I have just researched in this area a little too much with some work of my own.
Yeah, well, one of your short stories, it did actually remind you of it. It reminded me, not you. It might have reminded you, but it certainly reminded me of your short story.
Yeah,
what was it called?
The Home for Broken Dolls.
Yes.
Which was about the...
But that one's more explicitly they're sentient or they're
yeah.
They're,
yeah,
and there's a slavery thing going on there, and an abuse
and a consent
thing
and all of that
thing.
Sort of stuff.
Yeah,
but
I had the same.
But
feel
as I said,
about
maybe if I hadn't researched so heavily into this area, the new boyfriend as a story would have felt less like, oh, it's just one degree to the left of our world, or possibly to the right of our world, as the case may be. Because yeah, honestly, what Kelly Link does though, even with the stories where there are the pocket universes in Light and the Summer People, which is a wonderful story. It opens a collection and it's a beautiful.
It's a bit too good.
I love this story.
It's a bit too good.
Bit too good for
for
the rest of the collection.
Yeah, I don't know.
Too strong an opening, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know if any other story. There is something. I love Two Houses. Mm. And I do love Light as well, but the Summer People is just.
It seems to have.
I feel like the Pulitzer people, because this was shortlisted.
Yes.
I bet you they just read Summer People. Said, this is just. We don't have to read the rest. This is just awesome. No, I know, which has been insulting for me to say.
There's a different. It's a different quality to the. To the air, you know, in Summer People.
But you know what's interesting? I actually think it's the most conventional story in the whole collection. In that it does have a clear beginning, middle, and
in
very
terms of
dark
the structure.
End.
Yeah, it is. I don't know that it's a dark end.
I think you're wrong.
Okay. I can be wrong.
Please, people, seriously, go read The Summer People now.
Yeah, we're not going to speak. We don't often spoil collections.
I'm going to spoil The
Summer
People.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because, I'm going to debate
you. I don't think it's so bad.
She. Friends, there's a girl who one mm-hmm. of the Summer People who's now a permanent resident.
Oh, it's not
and
good
I forgot
for her
the names.
Friend. It's fine for her though.
I felt really bad because her friend looked after her when she was sick.
Her friend got what she wanted. And what do they say in fairy tales?
But she
be careful what you wish for.
Oh, come on! I get the point.
She's going to go back. Her friend's not there forever.
I don't think that was the that was not the feeling I got.
Well,
how
is it more fair for her to be stuck?
No,
there?
It's not. There's a key, consent, slavery, that sort of thing.
This
being
is
abused.
Kind of the situation.
No, her situation. And again, I'm sorry. I have problems with character names. So, but I
Fran
is a Fran. Yes,
Fran. Ophelia, who's her friend, who gets stuck there.
I don't think that what the situation Fran is in is a good one. She's clearly being abused, not physically abused, but just abused in the sense that she's not allowed to do anything beyond look after these fairies or whatever they are.
And in a way, I mean, there's a line in that story where her father's talking about, the class of people who do things for the other class of people who they could do for themselves, but you know there's a money transaction and this is how the world works. And in a sense, I mean, yes, this possibly I think the Summer People is possibly the most transparent in terms of how it overlays on the world, because it sort of does push at the ideas that there are a whole bunch of people in the world, a lot more people in the world than who aren't, who are beholden to others, and their lives are spent doing others. Like everyone who has to work over Christmas and Easter and public holidays because other people want to go and get drunk and have a good time. Everybody who has to do the night shifts in hospitals and in fire stations because the rest of us want to feel safe. Everybody who has a job or a position or a role in life, it might be taking care of an invalid relation or someone like that. Every one of these people is beholden to someone and doesn't have a choice to leave.
And that's why Light is the last story in the collection, because it's about exactly the same things. It's about obligation and responsibility.
Yeah.
The character in that story, the new character names.
It was Harper and Tarn.
Oh, you are.
I'm much better with character names.
People will be thinking you're looking this up. You just bang that out of the top of your head.
Because if it's a good story, and this is often, I'm not even being facetious here, this is often a good litmus test for how connected I am to a story. If I can't remember the character names, it wasn't a good story.
Well, Harper is the female character, yep.
No. It's two gay guys.
Light.
I'm sorry. I thought you were. Oh. Well,
no, not the one.
The last...
No.
Sorry. I thought you were talking about the lesson.
No, the one where when they go off to the island,
right?
And there's the crab claw or whatever it's called.
The bad bear claw or something like that. So the pocket universe story.
Yeah,
with
so
the sleepers.
You've just undermined your entire. If it's a good story.
No, I remembered the characters. I just remembered them in a different story because I am crap at titles.
Anyway, Light. let me get to my point. What was the name of the female protagonist?
Oh, now I am undermining myself because I just – is it Lindsay?
Yeah, or? I was thinking Lindsay.
It is Lindsay. Yeah, there we go. I've just looked at it.
So Lindsay feels she's responsible both for her brother, who was her shadow that broke off.
Yes.
And for the job that she does and for these sleepers that they find.
People that
she's constantly feels responsible, much like Fran feels responsibility. Yeah. And in both cases, in both cases, they escape their responsibilities.
Yeah.
It's much more hopeful and nicer in light because you feel, woohoo, she's got away in a sense, walked out of a pocket universe during a hurricane, and there she is. Fran, on the other hand, has left her friend to the shit.
Okay, so here's what's really interesting to me. So as you say, they're both the same sort of stories. You've got two characters who have seemingly inescapable responsibilities, and there's in both cases there are fantastical elements. So with Fran, there are these fairy-type creatures called the Summer People who she has to – She and her mother before her are beholden to look after these creatures and see to their every whim. And in return, they provide her with things and they look after her. I mean, it is, you know, it's definitely she's on the lower end of that seesaw, but it's not like she gets nothing out of it. And then you've got Lindsay in her story with, yes, her brother and her the people she's looking after, the sleepers. And, yes, they both escape. So why, like, my question to you is – So what Lindsay does – sorry, so what Fran does is leave her friend in the same position she was,
yes,
taking care of the fairy people and being at their beck and call and in return getting her heart's desire possibly or just seeing it, which might be worse. And when Lindsay goes away, she abnegates responsibility for all those sleeping people. She leaves her brother there on his own. She leaves the employee who she liked and was mentoring on his own. And all that responsibility and all that is just gone, and those people now have to pick up after. Well, how is it for both stories? The protagonist escapes and has a happy ending, and for both stories, the people left behind don't. So is it because we're you're more attached to Ophelia that you see that as a worse ending in The Summer People than in Light?
Yes.
Right.
Because Ophelia actively does nice things for Fran. She looks after her.
So does Jason.
Jason, the security guard.
Yeah. He tries to commit suicide, and then she just leaves him there with a brother. And he one of the good guys.
Jason also, didn't he try to blackmail her?
Only because in a jokey way, like, I want my job.
Plus,
don't fire me because.
Plus, he lied to her. See, Ophelia never lies to Fran. He lied to her, saying that I've sorted out the sleepers.
He did sort out the sleepers.
Yeah, well, exactly. But
no, but you know what I'm saying.
It's a fair point.
Yeah,
it's a fair point.
So is your?
I think the other reason I feel that way is that Fran actively made a choice to do that to her friend. For Lindsay, it's coincidental to an extent because the hurricane.
She makes the choice to leave. What happens is the hurricane occurs,
which basically destroys areas around her. Mm-hmm. But a pocket universe opens bisecting her door, and she realizes, shit, that's nice out there. Well, fuck it, I'm going to go.
Whereas, but she makes the choice to leave. It's not as though she's sucked out of the world against her will.
She does make the choice.
She packs up. She takes the things she wants to take. She takes a little iguana. And off she goes. She makes the choice to leave behind everyone.
Pushes Ophelia subtly because she does warn her. Are you sure?
Yep.
Do you really mean this? But subtly pushes her into servitude, whereas Lindsay is giving it to her on a platter, and she says, "Well, fuck it, I'm going."
Yeah.
That's why I felt more comfortable about one over the other. It is brilliant though that Kerry Link has written a collection that does that.
Yeah.
They're shadows of each other. They're shadows fucking everywhere. There's one story, the ones with the face, the Valley of the Girl.
Oh, my goodness, the Valley of the Girls.
Which I had to reread.
Oh.
Not in a bad way. It's one of the very few stories I've ever felt the urge to go straight back to the front and reread because it's this story where
– it's really nonlinear.
It's not just that it's nonlinear. It doesn't tell you anything at the beginning. It dumps you in and you don't know. It keeps talking about faces. And you think, do you mean a person's face, as in actual face, or is that something else? And yes, fuck it is. It's this not a facsimile, although.
No, like that's the amazing part of it.
It's this idea and it's fucked up, truly fucked up, and yet you could see it happening. We're rich people. don't want to be embarrassed by their kids. So, just on that. So they hire another person to be their child who gets educated, bloody, bloody, blah, and is a good and acts as a perfect citizen. So there aren't YouTube videos or whatever of their child acting up, which will embarrass the family.
And also, and I know it's done as a partially a throwaway because the narrator of this particular story is the teenage boy. So he obviously is quite.
He's having an affair with the face
of his sister.
Of his sister.
Yeah. So he's obviously quite skeptical about whatever adults tell him. But I think there is some truth in the idea that this system is also set up so that when you become an adult, you are not dragging this embarrassment of your teenage years behind you and everything you put on Facebook Correct. And everything you put on YouTube and everything you tweeted. And you get to start at the age of 18 or 21, whatever it was, with a clean slate. And I think, like, the narrator in the story, who we never know his name because he doesn't want us to know his name, kind of is very cynical about the parents saying that this is why they do it. And he says, oh, they're only doing it because they don't want to be embarrassed. And I think it's both. I think it's both. And, like, it is an interesting idea, isn't it, that if you get to start your adulthood with all of those, as you and I did, Ian, because we grew up and became adults before the internet. So all those embarrassing things we did as teenagers, they're just written down on paper. They're in actual Correct. Photos in people's photo albums. There's, you know, they're not hanging clear. Around on our Facebook accounts. They're not hanging around online forever. We don't have that. We are these kids.
And we should be clear, it's not like the real sibling is or child is hidden away.
No, no, no. They live their life. They just live their life non-publicly. So Correct. They're not included in any photos. They're not included in the non-public child.
Yes, you're right. It's
which is quite a freedom to have.
That's the problem.
Actually.
There's a disturbing dark logic to the whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
And but, then it's and so there's literal a shadow. There's another shadow because there's this duplication and it's. And then it's got this whole Egyptian thing going, running through it, which is just,
yes,
again, odd. And it's this idea. I mean, it's a bit like Origin Story. Again, you don't know titles, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Which, oh, no, that's the other superhero
correct.
One. Yeah.
Which, for reasons that I think probably went a bit over my head, is set in a broken-down Wizard of Oz theme park.
Yes, which was probably my favourite thing about this. I didn't really connect to that story a lot. I can't remember. No, I can. Bun and Tina and Biscuit were the characters' names. But I can't remember them because they were weird names.
No, but it's this brilliant working class, a bit like Summer People, it's this brilliant working class exploration of superhero. How it's just we assume that all superheroes are this elite group of people who fight crime and save the world.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're just people who can float 2 feet above the ground.
And well, they're not the superheroes and that's sort
well,
of the
no,
difference.
But Biscuit
you've got
is.
This yeah, but you've got this like in from what I can glean from the story, you've got this world where a whole bunch of people can manifest powers of some sort. But they're divided again on a basis of the usefulness, I guess, of their powers. So yeah, if you're like Bunantine and her mother, your power is that you can essentially levitate a couple of feet off the ground and that's it. You know, it comes in handy if you have a big fall because you can stop yourself actually hitting the ground by, you know, stopping those last couple of feet. But yeah, if you're a waitress, you can levitate and like, you know, take some pressure off your ankles and your varicose veins. But that's about it. So all those people who have some special power of some kind are still just, they're just people who have this thing that they can do. It's only the people who have this extra ability.
It's rare that you get that perspective from a superhero because that is what it is. It's a superhero story. It's rare that you get that sort of working class, blue collar take on it.
Yeah.
And they are working class and blue collar because their powers, as you say, aren't important or special enough.
Yeah, there's just not a lot of use to them, really, to the outside world. I mean, what's the point of someone who can fly when they can only fly 2 feet above the ground?
So you didn't like that story?
It was okay. Like, I liked all the stories. Let me just say, there really isn't a dud one in this collection. I liked some a lot more than others. And that was one of the ones that was just,
It starts
story.
Too strong with the Summer People.
The Summer People is a really, really good story. But I think, I love The New Boyfriend. I thought that was such a good story. And
of course,
didn't go where It didn't go any of the places I was half expecting it
to go. Actually, I don't think any of these stories go any of the places you're expecting them to go, if you have expectations, which is rare because they're just so weird.
I mean, that's a story with a really dark ending. The new boyfriend.
Yeah, oh, yeah, shit, yeah.
You know. And, yeah, it's just like it's a really good collection. And what I admire about Kelly Link's writing is that she will take these ideas like, you know, the superhero stuff and she will just sort of lay them in there in the background.
Yep.
And they're not what the story is about. The stories are about the people and their situations in the world. Correct. And how they're getting by. And the fantastical elements or the speculative elements bolster that. They're not there just for decoration. They're not there just to say, hey, I'm a spec fic story. They're an integral part of the story that Kelly Link is telling and the world that she's building. But they don't overpower that. They're not like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if there were superheroes in the world and they were just like dentists and they're at a convention? Like, that's not what that story is. That it informs that story. And the fact that Paul Zell, who's the online boyfriend, could possibly be one of the superheroes is a neat little thing. But it doesn't overpower the story, which is about Billy and her life. And I loved her voice. I loved how that story was told because it's told by Billy, but it's told in the third person because she's kind of deeply embarrassed about various things she did on that weekend, as she possibly should be. So she can't quite bring herself to write this letter to Paul in first person a lot of the time.
Is it rude, therefore, to say that there is a certain literary qualities to this to these stories?
Oh, for God's
sake. No, literary.
Do we have to have this conversation again?
All right. Yeah,
no, fine. Actually, no. Why? Let me read.
So you happen to have a response prepared if I ask that asinine question, literature versus genre?
Well, it's just that I read this on the train in this morning and it's from the LA Times and it was a review of Get in Trouble by David L. Ullen or Ullen. And I'm just going to read the last part of the first paragraph. You know what? No, I'm going to read the whole paragraph. It's tempting to describe Kelly Link as a fantasist or a magical realist of a particular homegrown sort. Her stories take place within recognisable landscapes, suburban bedrooms, reality TV locations, a wedding weekend, that open into something else. Slipstream, author Bruce Sterling has called this style of writing, genre work that blurs the lines of genre, merging elements of science fiction, realism, fantasy. Yet all that seems too restrictive, too didactic for what Link appears to have in mind. And I just, like, I'm uncomfortable with this idea that genre is restrictive, that genre cannot be literary, that genre can't be all of these things and still be genre. You know,
I agree with you. I don't ask the question to create this artificial divide.
Oh, I know. But I don't know, like.
But that seems to be what people want to do, though.
It is, and that's the problem because as soon as you start saying, "Well, is there a literary quality to this genre writing?"
I know,
you're like, "Well, I'm sorry, why should it not have a literary quality?" Genre is marked by tropes and motifs, and in various ways, sometimes by a certain style or approach of storytelling. It is not marked, or it shouldn't be marked by the quality of the prose or the literariness of the prose. I mean, that should have nothing to do with
where something falls in
a genre.
So when a book like this and the next one we're going to discuss have a tricksiness to them, when they're also, and especially the next book, are very aware of what there's an awareness to the text, to the narrative. Not a it's not metatextually specifically, just there's a clear awareness, okay? Not to the extent that you can see the cogs and wheels that make the story, but there's a genuine cleverness that comes through and tricksiness that comes through.
Yeah. So
you can't help but want to say, oh, let's keep it away from genre, which is meat and potatoes, because that's how it's classified.
Making me angry.
And put it in another category altogether.
And when we do that, you know what we're left with? Just left with crap genre.
Yeah,
because if we take out all the good stuff and the clever stuff and the tricksy stuff and the stuff that is aware of itself and the genre in which it sits, if we take all of that out and say, oh, this is somehow better, then all we are – it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's the whole, all that's then left is rubbish.
And what we've done by doing that –
and we say, well, that's what genre is, it's rubbish.
I agree with you. What we've done by doing that is that's what the cultural wars are now.
Yeah.
So we've gone and said that all these things that are a bit tricksy and weird and narratively clever are over here. And, yeah, that leaves all the shit, as you said, the meat and potatoes. And, in fact, that's the stuff we're going to ignore. And those people who love that stuff go, fuck you, you left-wing elitist establishment, New York publishers, whatever. Fuck you and your fucking tricksy shit that doesn't make sense anyway and, you know, is incomprehensible. And really what genre is this meat and potato stuff and always has been, always will be, and you will go get fucked. And that's what that's the cultural wars that we've gone and created for ourselves. I know,
but it's like
– whereas what we should be doing is saying, fuck, this is just beautiful, brilliant genre work.
It really, really is. And I don't think Kelly Link would disown her genre.
Oh, absolutely.
Her and Gavin Grant run Small Beer Press. They publish great works of – speculative fiction.
But the LA Times would like to.
Well, like it's a funny thing because there's like this – and often when you read one of these appraisals of a book that's – that the reviewer doesn't really want to talk about as genre, you get this dissonance in the text. And like it's evident in that bit that I read out where he talks about slipstream fiction, and he says, you know, it blurs the lines of genre, it merges elements of science fiction and fantasy and realism, and yet that seems too restrictive. How can that be restrictive? How can blurring and merging and taking everything and putting it together and pulling it apart be restrictive?
Because there's this whole view that those things have rules, very clear, established rules, and because she's breaking those rules, she's doing something. She's not actually in those camps anymore.
I don't think she is actually breaking any rules.
The Summer People is such a conventional genre story.
I think
story.
That's not a bad thing, I should say.
No, but The Summer People is a conventional genre story.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. It's, in a sense, meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
It's just fucking brilliant. It's elevated to a level of, you know, high cuisine. It is amazing.
And the rules that are often perceived as being broken are the rules of quality. To put it bluntly. So the perception that genre work really is just by the numbers and so on. So whenever you do get an author like Kelly Link, people who are not, I think, within the genre for the most part, do start saying, well, this is not really genre work because it's breaking the rules. But all she's doing is breaking the rules of perceived rules that genre work doesn't have quality prose work, doesn't have the cleverness and the tricksiness. It doesn't have a self-awareness. So they're the rules that people perceive are being broken. And it's rubbish. I mean, Kelly Link's work is
and by the by, she's not alone in the genre space. She's not the only writer.
No.
I mean, we've reviewed a fuck ton of novels in this podcast of writers who are Lisa Hannett's first book.
Yes.
You know,
first novel.
Sorry, first novel. Yep. Yeah, Angela Slater does it. And I've just picked those two you know, off the top of my head, I mean, I've reviewed so many people. And I'm reading so much at the moment. But there's just so many out there who are playing in that, who would classify themselves as genre writers, who are playing in this space. It's not just Kelly Link. She's been noticed and good on her. She deserves it.
Can I just read out, just while we're on the subject about her being noticed, because I love this. I just printed out the page from the Pulitzer website. Because on the Pulitzer website, they have just a little thing about all of the finalists who make the list, because they don't have a shortlist and then a winner. They announce the winner, and they also have,
and the winner I read actually
was a good?
Yes, it's a very good book. Okay. What they do is that they announce a winner, and they always have two finalists with it. The second finalist is a book I can't remember, but I did read the winner.
So the winner was A Sympathizer.
Yes,
right. I should say by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Nguyen, yeah, that's Nguyen. Right. It's very good.
So with all of the finalists, they just have a little one line about them, and I loved the one line about Get in Trouble. It was a collection of short stories in which a writer with a fertile and often fabulous imagination explores inner lies and odd corners of reality, which is what it is, but it's so much more than that.
But it's that oddly patronising pat on the head A writer with a fertile sickness.
It's fabulous to imagine.
Yeah. Yes. Something not entirely right about said writer, but here's a participation of it.
I didn't read it as that. I read that. It's just a bit twee. I just think that's how the Pulitzer people talk.
Now, we should move on to the second book.
We should.
Frankly, I could speak another hour about the get in trouble, but I've already hinted at the Helen Oyemi book.
So, yes. So,
which has the long title of
What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours, which is not the longest title this book has to offer.
No, that's true.
So this is a collection, and it's the first Oyemi book I've read.
Same with me. Which will shock some people because she's been.
Yeah, I've got A Boy Snowbird on my shelf as well, but I haven't read it. And I chose the short story collection because we also were doing a Kelly Link, and I thought two collections, fantastic. May get back to that Boy Snowbird at some other stage because I do want to read it as well. So this is the first of hers that I read, and oh, I'm so hooked. She is a delightful storyteller.
You like the story presence.
My one complaint, and it's nothing to do with Oyemi herself, my one complaint is, oh my goodness, this particular edition that I had, which is the Picador hardcover, no table of contents.
Really?
No table of contents. And no, so the header on every page is just the title of the book. So it makes it so hard to find individual stories. You literally have to flick through and find the title page of the stories.
Is this...
No, I think it's bad on Picador's part.
No, well, it may be.
Look, I made my own table of contents.
It's still a gorgeous... You did. With page numbers and everything.
It's a table of contents. It sits in the front of that book.
Staple it at the front.
It sits in the front now.
It is a very pretty...
Other than the lack of table of contents. Because either one of those would have been fine. Honestly, if they'd had the names of the stories in the header, that would have been okay. Could have done without the table of contents.
I do like the US cover more, though.
Yeah. Oh, the US cover's
really
nice.
Which has the puppety...
At the flame and the...
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like that. It's other than that, it's a beautiful book physically. But, oh, please, Picador, either table of contents or story titles on the header. I want to be able to go back and find them without flicking through the whole damn book. But I fixed it, Picador. I made my own table of contents.
You really did.
I really did. It sits in the front there now.
And this is, and remember, this is a person who doesn't remember titles. Story
no,
titles.
No, so how am I supposed to?
I know. Exactly.
No, I often remember if I look
but
at
But I was going to say,
yes.
Could this sort of be seen as a novel?
Oh.
And here's a word
a mosaic.
Well, here's a word I don't use much. Motif. Because this is a book that swims and revels in the concept of the motif.
With the keys,
the rose, the idea of secrets.
Yep.
Puppets. And all these fucking character names.
The characters appear in other.
Except for one story where it is actually the same people. Well, sort of.
There's always the same people.
No, it's not.
It is.
One of them's a man and then there's a woman. So how can that
Who's that?
Rada?
No, she's not a man.
I'm certain she's a man in one of the stories.
No.
They're not the same people.
They are. They're the same people.
How can they be the same people?
They are the same people. Rada and Moya references the puppet people.
There's a story, another pre...
And you've got the guy who's in the House of Locks. He comes into the story at the end about the young man whose parents run the hotel. They're all the same people, Ian.
No, I don't think they are.
They completely are.
All right, I'm going
to... They have to be. Like, it's not just their names, but, like, there's references to who they are.
Like, Tyke, who appears a few times, is not the same Tyke.
She's a puppet girl who was in the story about the puppets.
Yes, correct.
And then she was also the mysterious woman who was walking around the House of Locks, when that's how we find out who she is, because the lady she's in... I can't remember, Frank, someone checks in the hotel story with the guy who was living in the House of Locks, a famous guy, the actor. They're all the same people. You need to read this book again.
Have I failed?
I could be wrong, but I recognize them as the same people.
Well, Yeah, okay.
I think you need to read this book again.
Yeah, I'm sort of doing a sort of bit of a search through the ebook. Oh, fuck me.
But look, you know, this
did I misread it? I haven't been this bad since I did the China Mavel book that I completely misread. Do you remember that?
Which one was
the city
that?
The city.
I don't remember how you misread that one, but look, I mean, there is a dizzying array of characters in this book. I will give it that. And a lot of them are inconsequential.
I just didn't see them as the same. They just didn't feel like the same people. They felt the names were obviously the same. They just didn't present. It's definitely the last story where there's clear connections.
Yeah,
the Grimaldi's mentioned, Gustav's mentioned in terms of puppetry. But yeah, I mean, it's just so obvious now that how the fuck did I miss that?
Can I ask, because this is interesting, can I ask you a question? As a reader, are you a visual reader? Like, do you visualize?
Yes.
And is that a really significant part of reading for you? So when you're reading, you visualize what characters look like, what the rooms they're in look like, that sort of thing?
Yeah, but not to great detail. But yes, I do visualize to an extent, yeah.
Okay, because that's really interesting, because I've read a review of What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours in The Guardian by Kate Clancy, and she made a point that that there's not a lot of what she calls as sensual cues, so and also not a lot of visual cues. So she says, for example, in the story Is Your Blood As Red As This, which is the puppet story we've been mentioning, this story takes Oyemi's radical disregard for physical description to the point of perversity, as we are called upon to imagine a large and elaborate school of puppetry, staff, students, puppets, and audience without any sensual clues whatsoever, not so much as an eyebrow or a crinkle of papier-mâché.
It is confusing because it also suddenly changes perspective.
She goes on to say that in other stories also there are a scant few descriptions of things. And it's interesting because I read that and went, because I'm not a visual reader. I'm really not. I'm definitely not one of those readers who can picture characters. So over the years when people have – like when a book has been made of a movie has been made of a book and people have said, I wouldn't have pictured that person as that character, I could never quite understand what they meant because I don't picture characters. I don't picture scenery. So I'm wondering if you're quite a visual reader and I'm not, was that part of it? Because this book doesn't – and I hadn't realized it reading it. I only realized it after I read this particular review. So if you're quite a visual reader and you're relying on cues about what characters look like and their physical manifestations of, you know, quirks and their physicality, if that's not there, maybe that's part of why the characters didn't feel consistent or as the same people, whereas I'm really not that kind of a reader. So that absence didn't affect me whatsoever. Like, that's really interesting to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, because I'm thinking the first time we're introduced to Tyche, T-Y-C-H-E, is in the story Sorry Doesn't Sweeten Her Tea, which is the one about the celebrity YouTube clip. It's a story about abuse.
Yeah, and the clinic where people go to lose weight by
And she's working at the clinic.
Sleeping.
Yes, and that's where she's working.
Yeah.
She's working at the clinic.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if puppetry's mentioned in that story.
No, it's not, but this is something she's done later.
Yeah, but see that's – it just didn't – the type of the puppetry story is this enigmatic, slightly weird character who is – because she's the one with the chess pieces, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Because there's no visual cues, I just didn't.
That's really interesting. As I said, it's not because that's not how I read. It's not something I notice.
I just thought Oyemi was just playing around with names. Mm. You could argue because I've seen reviews that have said Nina Allen writes one for Strange Horizons, and I don't have it here, so I don't want to take her out of context. But she said that she loved the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved it on a sentence level, but she didn't like it as a package because partly she didn't see it coming together. The motifs didn't – there was no resonance in the motifs. They don't seem to tie together. Mm-hmm. And I can sort of get that point. I mean, the rose, The secrets, yeah, okay, that I sort of got. But the key that seems to pop in, I mean, it's not the same key, but just the idea of keys.
Yeah. I think, and this is why I would not make the argument that this is a mosaic novel. I think it is a collection of short stories, and I think you have recurring characters and, as you say, recurring motifs and certainly recurring themes, and it makes it a cohesive collection. But I don't regard it as a collection I need to walk away from in the sense that I might lament for the afterlife and feel yeah. like I need this to be a cohesive whole story that has been pieced together. But what I really liked about Oyemi's writing, and as I have no idea if at novel length she writes in the same way, but and it took me I think a couple of stories to really sink into it, because she's so playful in the way she tells stories and the tangents that she goes off on, and the way that she will set up a story to make you think it's going to be about something, and then like Sorry Doesn't Sweeten Her Tea, where you think it's actually going to be about this clinic.
Yes, that the woman works
in, and which is kind of a creepy clinic and could definitely be a story all on its own. And it goes off on this other tangent, but it's all related because it's all about superficiality and appearances, and what that clinic is underlying the world building that yep. allows for the story we actually get to happen. So I really began to appreciate her type of storytelling and the tangents and the throwaway characters and all of that. And I found myself as a reader, less reading it like and trying to grab onto at every second exactly what was happening and where does this person fit and how does that scene fit in with this, but just letting the story unfold and go off on little side paths and come back again. And I really loved these stories, and I can't exactly explain why. Because we talk about breaking rules of stories. I think what Oyemi does is break almost every classic cardinal rule you're told when people teach people how to write short stories.
Well, they do. They did feel like a Simpsons episode to me, where the Simpsons often starts with a tangent. The opening is often a tangent to the main story. It's got nothing to do with the main yep. story, but it does link in some way. And they all.
And you've got some that are clearly nested stories. So. Yeah. Books and Roses, is that the name of the first one? That's clearly a little nest of stories, which is about storytelling. It's just beautifully.
Well, it's about stories. Yeah. It's about books. It's about
And the way the stories come together, it's a lovely, lovely story that opens a collection. So and there are several sort of nested stories in these stories. You'll have characters who will tell anecdotes to each other. You'll have narrators who will tell you a little side story about something which may or may not be relevant to the main story that happens. And it reminded me, I think, when I kind of allowed myself to go with that, it reminded me a lot of sitting around a big dinner table with family and friends, and you're telling stories, and you end up at some point not finishing the story you started, but ending up at a different story. And yeah. it's much
like this podcast,
in a really good way, though, you know, because everything was engaging. And I mean, there are some stories which I guess are more conventionally structured than others.
What did you think? I was curious. What did you think of the Red Riding Hood story?
I love that story,
but that's not connected really to.
No, it's not, and I don't think.
And that's where I got. I don't know. Maybe that's also off.
Like I said, I don't think this is not a mosaic novel. This is a collection of short stories, and you have some recurring characters and some recurring themes. But I do not think, like with the Kelly Link story, a collection actually, I don't think every story is meant to connect to every other story. It's a collection. It's not a novel. It's not even a mosaic. It's a collection.
This is the problem I have, that I start reading, and because I get quite nervous sometimes when I can see this is a smart piece of writing, I'm going to miss something. And I don't know, books do often make me anxious on that sort of level.
Yeah, I can see.
Especially if you're going to speak about it on a podcast.
I can see you don't want
to make a complete ass of yourself. When you start to see characters pop up, and that you assume you just can't help but ask, what's going on here? Motifs are popping up.
Yeah.
Characters are popping up.
Thematically, but having characters, Like, that's not a novel thing.
But I didn't even fucking think they were the same people. No,
well, that's very true. but I mean, this is not a novel thing. Having recurring characters in an author's work is, yeah, it's not uncommon. I think what these, like, I really like the title of this book. I really do. And it's a very, like, it's a title that has a lot of sort of mystery to it, and it definitely drew me to the book. And it's also, it's one that I thought about a lot while reading it. And in a lot of ways, like,
well, you couldn't help it because it was on the bloody title page of
every single page. Yeah. What is yours? What is not yours? Is yours. Not yours? But every, like, all of the stories, all of the kind of resistance the stories had to resolving ambiguities, because every story's got ambiguity in there. Yes. There's tangents that trail off and don't get resolved. There are often endings that are not explicit. And it's sort of the title just kept echoing, because it's like what is being presented here is what's being given to me, and what is not there is not mine to know. And that's the case with every book, but I haven't felt that about a book in a long time, that the book was quite deliberately withholding a lot of stuff. And it wasn't that I felt that was frustrating. In fact, the book was reminding me that's not, I don't get to see that. I don't get to know that. I have what is here. And the last story, the super long title, yes, about a locked book. What is it?
It's the best title ever. If a book is locked, there's probably a good reason for that, don't you think?
Yes. And there was. And there's it's a really straightforward, simple story. And I'm only saying this because I've read this alongside the Kelly Link, but it did actually remind me of, like, that's, of the whole collection, that story felt like,
Presence actually felt like a Kelly Link story to me.
Oh, could have been a little. It was more the if a book is locked, because, it was a very standard story about office politics and, yep, and a new woman who comes to work at an office and how the other mostly women in that office feel, and the protagonist character who first doesn't like her, and then when everybody turns against her actually takes her side.
And she leaves a diary behind.
And she leaves the diary is stolen.
Yes, that's true.
A diary that she kept only as a teenager for a couple of years, and then just carries around with her. And this is the woman who came to the office, Eva. And that is stolen from her, and she's basically blackmailed to quit her job, and then she can get the diary back, which is awful. And so our narrator, who I can't remember because I think that must be a first person. So she ends up taking the diary to try and track down Eva. But she can't track her down to give it back, so she opens the diary, takes it to her grandmother, who's this wonderful little side story in this very small story, to pick the lock, and then she can get an address. And the book, when it's unlocked, like, unfurls,
yes,
and becomes big and fills a room, not with its physicalness, but, well, with that too, but also with what's in it, and it becomes audible, and it's this most amazing scene, and it's this little overlay of the fantastic onto otherwise a very realistic story, but then you have the ending, which is quite lovely too.
On the rooftop,
yeah. And
I think her name was Susie. I'm not sure, actually.
It's difficult with a first-person story because you often don't get the first name a lot, if ever. And as I said, I'm only making the comparison because I read it alongside Kelly Link. Otherwise, I don't think I would have thought of it. But
it's not first-person.
It's not?
No, it's... I'll read the first few sentences. Every time someone comes out of the lift in the building where you work, you wish lift doors were made of
glass.
That's
right. It's second person. Yes. Oh, yes. That's another thing I actually loved about it, but I'd forgotten. And that's why we don't know her name, because it is the second person. Really, really good second person narrative for all of those people out there who go, oh, second person, oh, that's just dreadful. Read this story. And then read some stories by Chimamanda Adichie, because she also writes in second person extremely well.
As just an off.
Sure. Yeah, yes. I'm a big defender of second person. I acknowledge that, like, 90% of the time it's atrociously done, but when it's done well, it is the most intimate people, point of view you can write
Because people
in.
Think of it from a choose-your-own-adventure point of view, from when they were kids.
They also think of it as just from a pretentious point of view. And this is because we don't write a lot in the second person. We speak a lot in the second person, a lot, but we don't often write it. But when it's done well, it's the most intimate point of view. It's just gorgeous. And Oyumi does it amazingly in that last story. And,
I loved it too, but I found that these were stories where if I wasn't on ball, I would get lost.
I don't think that's easy to do.
I keep mentioning Presence because it was my favourite story.
Yeah, I like that one. I like the conceit in Presence.
Well,
and the story that's built around it is amazing. But the thing that's at the middle of
the problem, it was odd because there's this last third where Jill. Because it's an experiment, but I sort of forgot the thread of what they were trying to experiment on.
So the experiment was simply to see if this technique this that therapy, her husband had devised would work, and it was like a grief alleviation therapy. So that's all it was. It was just to see if it would work.
Yeah, but but the outcomes that she basically sees a son she's never had grow up. In fast time, in bang, 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 the flat she's in is constantly stuck at 12:30 and it's getting colder and colder and colder.
It's a ghost story, but it's a ghost that never lived.
Yeah.
Like it's beautiful. It's such a lovely story. And it reminds me, I kept telling myself over and over how kind of extraordinary these stories are in that – like, as I said, they kind of break all of the rules of conventional storytelling, even unconventional storytelling, because they – like this story, really, there's so much of that story that's in the beginning that's about this relationship and Jill who thinks Jacob is having an affair this other woman, and that is like half the story.
Correct.
And I think to myself, like, if someone submitted this to my crit group, we, all of us, me included, would go, get rid of that. That's not important. You just need to start with them and the husband coming home and saying, I've got this idea for a therapy and I need your help to help me run it. I mean, the whole story's in the meat of the back end, and get rid of that first part. What the hell is that about? But I loved it. I loved that it was there. I loved that Jill had this other life, that, you know, her work at the prison with the boys. I loved that we got a really – okay, here's what I think. If we hadn't had – that first half of the story, which a lot of people might regard as extraneous, I don't think that Presence would have had the impact it did, because we wouldn't have had that relationship that got threatened. We wouldn't have had that. We would have had a generic husband and wife in a relationship, whatever we imagine that to be. But because we got all of this background told in a really engaging way, because you're going into this story and you think it's going to be a story about a relationship that's breaking up, and then it goes off on this tangent with the experiment and the ghost who's not a ghost but is still a ghost. If we didn't have that first half, we wouldn't really know Jill and Jacob, and we wouldn't know their relationship, and we wouldn't know how they feel about each other and what they fear and what they want and the impact of that story, which is all about what was given up for what they have.
Yes.
I don't think the impact would be there. It would just be, oh, here's a clever story about a ghost that never was. You know what I mean? So, and it's making me think about why.
But others would say if you wanted to pull that off.
Yeah.
And that's why I got lost at times, but not in a bad way. I was thrilled by that, believe it or not. They would say you've got to interleave it all. So you'd have the Presence bit at earlier as a sort of a foreshadowing or whatever, and then you'd go backwards and forwards.
Sure.
But she doesn't do that.
But the thing is, if you did it
it's actually a very linear story.
If you did it that way, though, and you interleaved it and you had it, you're getting that in context. You're getting that immediately juxtaposed with what's happening.
Yeah.
This way, what you're getting first without any prejudice, without any thinking about the situation that's putting them under stress or whatever, is you're getting that relationship and you're being forced to think about who they are.
And her paranoia, because she has got no evidence that he's having an affair.
No,
just this thing that he calls that there's an intimacy.
I wouldn't call it paranoia. I would call it anxiety. I would call it anxiety based on her previous experiences in marriage. It's not paranoia. Paranoia is unfounded fear. Based on her previous experiences, And also, and they've known each other since they were foster kids as well. So, yes. You know, she also knows him. And anyway, what I'm saying is we get all of that outside of the context of this thing that's about to happen, because we have no idea what the thing – there even is a thing about to happen. We get to build this picture of this couple, and especially Jill, the protagonist, and what the relationship is like and where they've come from and who they are. And we get that, and that is grounded for us as it is in real life before this other thing happens. And I think that's amazing.
I agree.
And it's, as I said, it's not something that you're taught to do when you write stories, and you're not something, it's not something that, as I said, if it came to in draft form to my crit group, we would have chopped half of it off.
But I could still see people say, no, it's wrong.
Well, it's clearly not wrong because it works.
Well, for you. And for me.
It can't work for everybody. No story can work for everybody.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're going to make statements
right,
like that.
This is what what I'm saying is I think we lose something when we start talking about three-act structure and here's what stories need to do and opening with inciting incidents and all. We lose something. All of that stuff is important to understand as a writer especially, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And when you read a book, like, what is not yours is not yours. By a writer who is exceptional as Helen Oyami is, I think that really comes out, because there are lots of different ways to tell stories that we don't tell stories in. And because we hone a particular narrative style, we lose all these other ways. And As with second person perspective, there are bad, you know, these other ways are challenging, and they're easily done badly, and possibly that's why we don't often do them. So, but it makes me sad. It makes me sad that we don't tell stories like this as well.
So I'd like to, that's what I agree with that.
Okay.
But in amongst all your talking, which was beautiful.
What did you find? I saw you tapping away there.
I know now where I got my confusion.
Okay.
So in the another story that I wanted to talk about, yep. Which is A Brief History of the Homely Wench Society.
Oh, that was such a happy story.
I know. And also about books.
Yes.
Like the first story. So, yeah. There is a reference to, because this is set in university, to a Professor Chowdhury, who is a man.
And you got him mixed up with Radha.
Who's also Radha Chowdhury, yes. I assume that because it's the use of
– Yeah, now, but it's the use
of
be.
No, but it's the use of – he's only referred to as Professor Chowdhury.
Yeah.
Here's where I got confused. It's – Chowdhury is the only recurring name that we've seen previously,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So, again, that's that idea of names appearing again, but this time it's a man.
Could be now, her father or grandfather.
Of course, yes, it obviously.
In fact, probably is.
It's her father or someone,
I didn't
yes.
pick that up.
But, yes, that's what I suppose got me all confused.
So I glossed over that name. And I think because, like in a weird way, what's it called?
A Brief History of the Homely Wench Society. Yeah.
That story feels more than any of the others that is almost outside of this collection. There's just a heightened degree of playfulness and comedy.
It's hilarious.
And there were, like, in so many of these stories, I actually laughed out loud at a line or two, because she's got quite a deft turn with
and it plays
with
you know,
wryness and black humor.
Gender, and it's got stuff about.
But the Homely Wenches Society is just out and out. It's almost a romantic comedy, but a really crunchy and smart one. And it's delightful, and the ending just made me grin. It's a beautiful, happy, wonderful, playful story, and I love it so much. And
what you're saying is, and yes, all that's true as well, what you're saying is that the Professor Chowdhury in this is obviously not Radha Chowdhury.
No.
Because it's probably her father or something.
It might be her father or, yeah, like I said, I didn't, that's
but that's the dissonance I suffered. I don't know Anyway.
Read it again. I think this, like, There's not every book I say this about. This is a book that will reward rereading.
I definitely think. But can we go back to The Homely Wench and how great that story is?
Yes, because I love that.
Because it starts with this brilliant letter written to an applicant.
Yeah, an email.
An email, sorry. Yeah, well, with footnotes and everything, saying, you know, you've got to justify
why you should be proud of our club.
Why should you be a homely wench? But it gives a history of the society, which, you know, is all about sexism, misogyny. I don't know if it's misogyny specific, but it is body shaming. So it's,
well, it came about because there was a men's only society at Cambridge.
The Betancourts.
The Betancourts. And one year, and I have no idea if any of this is true. I kind of hope it is. I don't care if it isn't. They decided to have, because they would invite the pretty girls every year for dinner.
Yes.
Once a year, a woman could enter if she was invited. And then one year, because some guy was being distracted or by beauty or whatever, he wanted to invite the homeliest girls. And so they all went out and made a list of all the homely girls, which, you know, at the time is basically...
Homely wenches.
Homely wenches, yeah. So the ugly ones, essentially, in their opinion. And this list got out and this... Yeah, so sisters in solidarity and started the Homely Wench Society. And
but also they tricked them by scaring the men or getting them to search for something
and then infiltrating
their dinner.
Yeah, that's one story, and that would have been an awesome story, but that's just the intro to the story that we get, which is lovely. And so that was the history of it, and so this story is set in the present day.
And you're right, it's a romantic comedy.
It's wonderful. Yeah. It's beautifully written. She's got... such a deft touch.
With a reference to... So this one...
With a reference to Lisa Tuttle's The Pillow Friend.
Could you believe that? Did you squeal?
I did. Inside. I wasn't.
I highlighted it.
I know. That made me really happy. Because one of the things they do is the current homely wenches break in to the Betancourts and swap library books.
Well, they decide that the boys will only have boys, if they have books. So they're not even sure they've got books. If they do have books, they'll only have boy books.
And they did only have like 10% books by female authors.
Yeah, so they decide
so they go in with, girl books and swap them.
And it's just...
But it's wonderful because they bring out all... Like, it's a swap for a swap. They don't just go and put their books on the shelves. They take one for one.
Yes.
And then they've got all these books that they're reading, and there's one comment where one of them says, well, you've got to give it to them. At least they have good taste. Because the books they've brought out are good books. Like, it's a beautiful story, and it's funny. And I realized a long time ago I'm not a comedic reader. I like comedy in movies and stuff like that and TV, and I love stand-up. I'm really not a comedic reader. That's why I never got into Terry Pratchett in a big way. I just, for whatever reason, however my mind works, words on the page don't really do the comedy stuff. I'm much more of a serious reader. But I do love the odd little bit of, you know, wryness and sarcasm and jokes on the page. And there was like jokes all through this book.
Oh, it is. It's just beautiful.
Just little thrown away bits of dialogue that make you chuckle.
I think we should also note, and I think it's true of both collections actually, that there's a lot about gender,
mm-hmm.
and there's also a lot about LGBT stuff. There's...
Because
you've got Rada and Myrna.
Yep.
So,
you've got that all the ways. You've got Sorry Won't Sweeten Her Tea, the couple... two men, and the one of them has a daughter from a previous relationship, and the protagonist.
And I only mention that this possibly is an irony by saying that they're not a big point is made of any of these relationships. They're there as they're not plot points.
They're no more significant than any heterosexual relationship in any story,
which I found delightful and refreshing.
Yes,
but the point that I'm mentioning it sort of undercuts. The fact, because I'm creating a significance where there was no significance in the book itself.
I think I think it is significant. I think the lack of significance is significant, though, because very often you'll get characters who are, either female characters or characters who are gay, and their gender or their sexuality or their race is the point of the story. It's what the plot circles on it. It's, you know, and it is refreshing. Like, those stories are important, but it is refreshing to have stories where it's just normalized and it just so happens to be a gay couple or a black woman or whatever. and that's not the point of the story. She's an Asian girl, but doesn't matter that she's an Asian girl. She's a puppeteer. That's actually what the story's about. The story's about her being a puppeteer and being in love with this other woman who doesn't love her. Doesn't matter what her race is.
And by the way, for sections of that story, we'll go into the perspective of the puppet.
Well, it's her, but...
No, it's the puppet.
It is the puppet, but the it depends how literally you take the haunted puppet thing, doesn't it? It reminded me a lot, actually, again, just in juxtaposition of the secret identity in Kelly Link. It reminded me a lot of that in terms of Billy telling her story in the third person. And I thought, this is like the puppet who is Rada telling her story to the puppet.
It is literally literally is the wrong word. It's as if Rada isn't in the room.
Yeah.
The puppet is...
Rada's in the room a lot. A lot of the time the puppet is observing Rada.
I get that.
Yeah.
But it was like the ground had been pulled from underneath me, because suddenly I thought, shit, wait, has this story all been told through the perspective of the puppet?
No.
But it hadn't. I know it hadn't. No. It's choppy. And again, it breaks the rules, because you could argue, what the fuck? The reader's got used to a certain, okay, yeah, we get multiple perspectives in short stories. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. But to have one introduced so late and then...
But it is chopped up. It's a two-part short story. It is segmented. So you've got part one is, I think, no, and part two is yes.
Yes.
So it's very clearly bifurcated and hinged down the middle.
Yes, true.
Yeah. So I think that one's very much flagged. It's not as though you're reading and then suddenly next paragraph it's the puppet.
Now, what did the motifs refer to?
Which ones?
All of them. The key. I suppose secrets and lock things. And
yeah, I don't think – I don't know.
How far does it become pretentiousness, and how far is it a cutesy little Easter egg that's in the stories? And what did because you want it to mean something, don't you? Or doesn't it have to mean anything at all?
No, it does mean something. It's like it's what I don't think there's underlying like secret meanings
and the
to
rings.
This stuff, right?
There's rings throughout as well, like.
But you just think about what keys mean, what rings – I mean, and not even specific reasons. I mean, keys unlock things. Keys keep things safe by locking things. You've got the house with all the locks.
Are you telling me how to apply
the beautiful thing, yes. Like you've got that story that the title I can't remember, but it's the one the one that made me – just got me twitchy because it had the Siamese fighting fish. And you can't that's not a female Siamese fighting fish. Female Siamese fighting fish are not the colourful ones and they don't fight and they're not aggressive. And I kept trying to read the story wondering if that's going to be revealed at some point, and it never was. So now I don't know if it's just an error or – anyway. But in that story with the Siamese fighting fish called Boudica, who can't be female because she's big and green and blue and frilly and aggressive, so she has to
be male.
That's
the sweet tea one.
Isn't that the one with the house and the locks? It is, yeah. So that one, yeah. Because there's so many stories in all the stories, it's hard to remember where they fit. But you've got,
sorry doesn't sweeten a tea.
That's it. So you've got the house of locks and where this other character lives who the narrator is going to visit. And there's a line in there which talks about, like, this house was originally owned by someone who found an eroticism in turning all the locks in the door and feeling the things fall into place and locking and unlocking things. And in a way, this is kind of what this collection is about. It's about unlocking stuff and keeping things secret and letting them out. I don't think there's any deeper meaning than that.
You've answered that one. What about the rose? It's even on the front cover of your edition.
That's the first story. The first story is about the roses and the books and the garden and the library and the thing.
But roses appear. All right, whatever.
I think there is as much meaning as you want to read into it.
Okay.
I really think that's it. I mean, all of these motifs, they're common things. They are things that are present in our cultural symbology. So keys and roses and shadows and books, all these things are weighted with symbolism. So all of that's there.
You know, that's
but they're also just keys.
Yeah, and they're just keys that unlock doors. Yeah.
And roses that you give to someone you love. And it's all of it. It's as deep as you want to go.
It's amazing. That second story is...
It's got everything in it, isn't it?
It's got everything.
It feels like it's about four different stories.
It is. It's got the House of Locks, as you said. It's got the sleep clinic where people are losing weight. It's got the celebrity who... Yeah. Abuses
the young woman.
The young woman, yeah. It never stops.
No, and it, but it is all.
And apparently, it's got the puppeteer Tyke in it as well. Yes. Just for giggles, shits and giggles. I mean, it's.
Yeah, look, I really love the way she wrote these stories,
and I wasn't expecting it because the first story is the is a nested one.
It is a nested story,
and it is conventional in many ways because I mean, nested stories
in structure. Yeah, yep, definitely.
And I wasn't expecting the second story to basically be a Simpsons episode where it starts off in complete, and then, and you're right, and the collection keeps doing that sort of shit. Yeah,
I think the way this collection was put together in terms of story order was really clever because it did ease you in to this type of storytelling and to not be wedded to the first character and setting that the story opens in. And what's quite remarkable about them is you get this wonderful medley in every story, and every single part of that patchwork could be a great story in itself. And she's, and I actually love that. Like it could have been really frustrating. And I think in the hands of a lesser author, it would have been, but she manages to give you these tantalizing glimpses into a story, and that's all you get. And what you don't get is not yours to get. And it works because they're all engaging and they all kind of work to bolster each other and reinforce each other.
Even a story like Drownings.
Oh.
Which is essentially a revenge tale.
Oh, I love that story.
But it doesn't –
I love the ending of that story.
It's about a
– A tyrant.
A tyrant. And it is a fairy tale. It's told like
that
a
one
fairy
really
tale.
Has a fairy tale-ish feel. Yeah, it does because it's one of the few that's not extremely contemporary.
But it doesn't necessarily start the way you'd expect it to start. It sort of does. Sort of,
it goes somewhere else.
Yeah,
it's got a dog who may or may not be a talking dog.
Yeah, it's.
I love
even
them.
The tyrant stuff doesn't feel initially to be the point of the story until it sort of is the point of the story, and then maybe isn't the point of the story because it's more about his daughter. It's.
I don't think any of these, like one of the remarkable things about them is that for all of these ones, which are patchwork sounds, it's not the right word, but I can't. It's more like a bricolage.
Haphazard also sounds bad. So
it sounds really bad. I'm saying bricolage. So all of these bricolage type stories, and not all of them are, because as we said, the first one is really a nested doll type of a story. The last one is quite a linear story. So with all of these stories that are, you know, are like a bricolage type work, they're still just wonderful to read. You just go along with them. Her voice is just beautiful. Yeah. And as I said, it did take me a little bit to I guess gel onto how this book was being told. But as soon as you give up trying to I guess control your reading and just let the stories be read by you. And that's not to say you're reading them passively, but you're not reading them in the same way that you would necessarily read, I think, the Kelly Link stories. I think they're quite delightful. I think they're quite a different reading experience.
There are connections.
Yeah, but I think they're a completely different reading experience. And I think you can go into them and go, well, these are just told wrong and there's all this extraneous detail and I don't know why we started here when here's where the real story starts. Or you can just kind of relax and enjoy a different type of storytelling that I think is really rewarding.
Can I quote what Nina Allen says?
Sure.
Because it's very interesting what you've just said, because this is in contrast. Because it agrees with what you've said, but twists it.
Okay.
This collection, this is Nina Allen from, this is on the Strange Horizons review of her review in Strange Horizons. This collection is as rich and strange as you are likely to find. It seethes with invention and originality, and yet I came away from it confounded by how little these stories affected me on any level other than the merely cerebral. My mind was left cluttered with images and metaphors, and yet I seemed unable to remember a single one of the stories distinctly set apart from the bigger-roar of its fellows. Now, I should point out that bigarrury, B-I-G-A-R-R-U-R-E, is a word that's in the Homely Wench one.
Yep.
Which is, and I actually looked it up too, and it does mean this sort of
running together,
like colours running together. Yep. Each story is about many things, yet none of them are truly about anything. Each contains a kernel of outrageous beauty or glorious transgression. The Gorilla Books swap in a brief history of the Homely Wench Society, the audacious lies told by Freddie about Ched and Tyke in Freddie Baranovchik's Inn, which is one story we really haven't discussed much. The bizarre act of deception perpetrated by the grandmother against the wolf beast in Dorinica and the St. Martin's Day Goose, which renders these tales exhilarating in their bombast and totally unlike any other story you might read on any given day. Yet for me, at least, they felt lacking in any emotional resonance whatsoever.
And I think that just that's just different readers. For
there are
me,
several leitmotifs.
Oh, sorry.
Key roses. No, no, I'm glad you jumped in there. There are several leitmotifs, key roses and puppets, running through the core of this collection that serve as loose thematic binders, but their importance feels circumstantial rather than being freighted with any deep meaning. And the same might easily be said of the recurrence of various characters from one story to another. See, she didn't get confused.
And I think that, I mean, that's fair. That's a fair reading. Like books,
is it?
Yes, it is. Books are not for everyone. Nina Allen did not get absorbed in these stories in the same way that I did. And that's fine. That's fine. We can't have, if every book appealed to every person exactly the same way.
No, no, wait a sec, wait a sec. Let's not go down that route of the, yes, everyone has different tastes and the subjectivity.
I think this is a different.
No, I want to focus on the specifics there, that this is a book that is about the tricksiness and the intellectual conundrum rather than the characters that exhibit the novel.
But
and
the moments that they exhibit. All I can say to you is...
Because I don't agree with that either.
Okay, but all I can say is that Nina Allen, who is a very smart person and one of my favourite critics, didn't engage with the characters. And I really did.
So did I.
And that is just a completely subjective engagement with the book.
I can't imagine walking away.
She said that
away.
She didn't have an emotional connection with the book. And I completely believe her. And for her, that's an absolutely valid response. But for me, I've also come away, and as we've seen in the discussion, I can't pinpoint sometimes exactly what bits were in what story.
I mean, she does say that your mileage may vary, which obviously she's thinking of you here.
Of course, thank you, Nina. I continue to have a strong emotional connection with so many of these characters and their stories, even though some of those stories are fragmentary.
I just can't see, and this is where I know it's subjective. I just can't say he can read the first story, which is this beautiful nest of dolls, we've said, about stories, about books. I can't see how you can read Homely Wench, which is just so funny and delightful and wonderful, or Presence, which is so powerful with this whole idea of the child that they never had, and not be affected. Not to say that Nina is some sort of...
You're a liar, Nina.
Or some sort of
You were crying when you read this book and you're ashamed of it.
She's some sort of Cyberman who can't, you know, get in touch with her emotions. But
I've had exactly the same experience reading books as she's described. I've had exactly the same experience. When I've read the book, I've really appreciated the way it was written. I've thought the writing was lovely and I felt absolutely no or minimal emotional connection to the book and the story of the characters. And I may still have quite intellectually appreciated the book. And other people have read the same book and gone, oh, how can you think that? I loved so-and-so and, oh, when they did that thing. Yeah. It is purely subjective.
I do think it goes deeper because there's a sentence. Sorry, Nina. And I could see where she's coming from here when she says in a paragraph before, she says that in the case of what is not yours is not yours, I found the hyperactive illogic, the pretty fabulism, the gosh-wow craziness of everything a reminder more than anything of how maddeningly mannered and tedious magic realism can be. Although she does say that normally she says, and whilst normally I would be a devoted advocate for stories such as these that deliberately flout over familiar MFA conventions, which we spoke about before, we spoke about MFA, but storytelling conventions, telling for all their worth, flipping carelessly, blah, 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 and then, you know, she says there's a tediousness to the magic realism, which I still don't agree with.
I didn't. And you know what? It's interesting, though, because this is a collection, and with the exception of probably the Homely Wench Society or whatever the full title of that is, the one about the locked diary, really, really long title, and probably the first one, so the Blood and Roses. I think if I'd gotten any one of those three isolated on its own in a magazine, in an anthology, fine, lovely story, beautiful. I think any of the others, I'm not sure how I would have felt about them. I think maybe this is a case of, for me, the sum being greater than the parts, and that having all of these bricolage type stories back to back and running into each other and characters running through each other's stories. Not that it's a mosaic novel, but it gave the collection, in a sense, more of a not a cohesiveness as much as a consistency in its inconsistency, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
I think some of those stories really, if they'd been isolated.
Like Presence. That's the one I keep coming back to.
Maybe,
but also
maybe
the second
not
one,
Presence, but to be honest, I may have had the idea with Presence as, hey, what is some of this being in here?
But
I
also
don't
the
know.
Sweetened Tea one, which just putting aside your Siamese fish issue, it does have about four stories in it.
Yeah. So, but see, I don't know that because I've come across them together. So I don't know. I don't know how I would have felt. I just wonder if I would have felt as, I guess, amenable or engaged if they weren't all presented to me en masse. I don't know.
A couple of them were collected separately, elsewhere. So an excerpt from Book and Roses was first published in Granter.
Mm-hmm.
Drownings was published, and I can see Drownings being published as a separate story because
that's it. The more actually I think about
and
them,
guess
the
what?
More I think most of them probably would be.
But
okay.
This is interesting. Dornica also was published separately. Again, it's a little fairy tale, but Sorry Doesn't Sweeten Her Tea was first published in Plowshares in July 2015. That's probably the one story I can't
imagine
as its own story. Yeah. And that's interesting.
But all right. But no, anyway, so.
You can appreciate Nina's view.
I can. And Nina Allen herself isn't saying, oh, this is a rubbish book, it's confused, it's all over the place. When I say that your reaction to a book and your appreciation of it and how much you engage with it is subjective, it absolutely is. That is a separate point to how good a book is.
Yeah.
And it's quite possible, as Nina Allen does on occasions, as we've done, saying, I can see this is a good book. I can see it's very well written. I can see what the author's trying to do. I just don't connect with it. And they're two separate issues. And for me, this was a double whammy for me.
I always find
because
that.
I loved it.
And I've always found that, what you've just said, to be a nice way of saying this book's shit. Because
if I think a book is shit, I'll say it's shit.
No, but see, I know that. But
it's not like I won't say it to the author's
face. I've said to myself, yes, the sentences are beautiful, the writing is gorgeous, but it's just not connecting with me. But why isn't it connecting? If it's... Okay, look, this is a deep philosophical question. We've already spoken for about 4.5 hours and I don't want to get into it, but it is something that does bother me.
I think it's just important to acknowledge that your own personal reception of a book or a movie or any other piece of art is governed by so many things beyond the control of the author. It's governed by your life experiences. It's governed by your knowledge of words and language. It's governed by the connotations that you drag along to every word and every type of character that you have. And this is all beyond the control of the author. It's beyond the control of the reader so much of the time. And I think it's not the job of most readers to differentiate between their subjective experience of a book and a more critical analysis of the quality of the book, but it is the job of critics. And if that's what we're doing here on this podcast, it is our job.
Okay, and I suppose my final question is, if the prose is beautiful, how did the book leave me cold?
Well, this one didn't.
I know. But it did.
Because I think it can, and I love words, so the beautiful prose is often enough to drag me through a book if it's just not a completely offensive story or something. But I understand that if you're not really, really engaged with that type of writing, it's not enough to pull you through, and that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
This has been great.
It has
been. I don't normally say that at the end of...
Yeah, you do.
No, I don't.
If you like them both.
No, not the books. This conversation has been great.
Yeah, it has been.
But we started too strong when you said that whole shadow thing. A bit like the summer people. When you said that, you blew my mind. I don't know. It was very hard for me to come back from that. So
okay. Well, anyway, so that was Get in Trouble by Kelly Link and What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours.
Which does not appear at all ever in the story.
By Helen Oyemi.
Get in Trouble is appears twice.
It doesn't, but I think What Is Yours Is Not Yours is a really good title for this book.
I agree. Doesn't appear though.
So clearly we both recommend them. That's it. What are we going to – that's it for the year. I've just realised. That's it. We're done. That's the year done. Next year, we're also we're starting with two collections of short stories again. We're going to look at Ghost Summer by Tananarive Due, who I've not read, and this is a book which just came out, I think, in September this year, and I've really been wanting to read her work. So we're going to start with that, and we're pairing it with a collection called Body by Asa Nonami. And again, it's an author who's kind of floated in the background for the last couple of years. I keep hearing her name. So I'd really like to read that. I think it's five stories.
I'm very excited. So the Tananarive Due, because again, another writer I've wanted.
Really looking forward to both of them. So they're up in January 2017. Oh my God, it's almost 2017. We're not recording in December because we never do.
Although this episode's probably going to get up in December.
This will be up in December because we're recording on the 25th of November, 26th of November.
You don't even know what day it is.
No, it's how busy my November's been. And I'm too busy in the next week to edit, so this will go up in December.
I just want to say that right at this point in time, Trump has still been elected.
We were not going to say the T word. We said it at the beginning.
Oh, that was the T word.
Oh, for God's sake. All right, I am done. So please send us feedback by commenting at the website.
That was the T word.
writerandcritic.podbean.com. Send us an email at writerandcritic@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter where we're at writerandcritic. And if you can, sponsor us on Podbean. Have a happy end of the year, everyone. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays, whatever holidays you're having. Or indeed, if you're not having holidays, have a good summer or winter.
See ya.
Bye.
What? Yes, I'm test. Yeah, here I am.
Sounded like Lurch from the Addams Family.